It's all fun and games until someone pops a vocal cord trying to imitate Nathan Queen on the Fish Golf Broadcast.
On this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast, I sat down with James Proctor. Proctor, what you thinking about?
I'm thinking about putting.
That seems to be your theme, huh? You're always thinking about putting.
Yeah, you know, that's where the money's made. They say drive for show, putt for dough. And to me, putting is, it's just an art form and it's a whole lot of fun. And it can be kind of scary at times, but it's all just how you look at it.
Yeah, for sure. Can I tell you, the very first person who told me about you was Dustin Keegan. This is about 2014 or 15. And he said, watch out for Proctor. He throws so far, so far, so far. Maybe that was true. But it took like 4 or 5 years for you to kind of make your stamp on disc golf after that, because you were pretty much playing regionally, in a way following kind of a similar career path to what I was doing. And now here you are on tour having like a sneaky, incredible season.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I think as a kid growing up, I learned on Stafford Lake, which was a big course, and you kind of had to throw far. So at first, that's what I wanted to do. And, you know, playing with the other guys in the area, I threw pretty far. And then Drew Gibson came up, and then I stopped trying to throw far. But, you know.
A little context and perspective there.
Yeah, exactly. I throw far on like a local level. And then once you get to the national level, then, you know, I kind of just go hide in my corner and make putts and try to keep up. But yeah, I learned real quick, you know, throwing far was fun and for show. But if you really wanted to score well in tournaments, you had to make putts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there was always the drive for show, putt for dough adage, but I think that's kind of been turned on its head with the little bit of advanced stats that UDisc has been able to provide on the Pro Tour, where getting to circle one or circle two in regulation is very, very key and is maybe the better predictor of who scores and who doesn't. Still, making a couple circle two putts per round, you know, that stacks up over the course of the tournament when the margins are really thin between, you know, fifth place and 50th place.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, only missing one or two circle ones for an entire tournament helps too. But you're right. The way they design courses now with all the out of bounds and just the amount of really hard, tricky bonus birdie type holes that we play, you have to get off the tee pad.
And I think a lot of that may, compared to golf, is that putting is really overpowered in disc golf. Like, mm-hmm. It's almost too easy to make a putt.
Yeah, I have always kind of been a huge fan of the target bullseye baskets, however you want to call them. I remember they did the tournament, I think it was in Utah, like probably 7 or 8 years ago.
Maybe Idaho?
Idaho. Yeah, one of those.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see that more. I wanted more tournaments to adopt that. And it hasn't really taken off, but I agree. I think our circles, especially, you know, on the Pro Tour level, are huge. And what I think it does is it bails you out of needing to be a really accurate thrower. And so for, you know, some par threes or a lot of upshots, I think, you know, for our talent level, if we were putting on a bullseye basket, everyone's still going to make the 15 footers. They're still going to make the bullseye putts, but the 25 footers, the circle's edge, the 40 footers, those become a lot more difficult. And so then you're really rewarding the guys who park it as opposed to the guys who are a little off and they're throwing at 30 feet. Then they really have to earn it with those putts. And so that's my kind of argument for those baskets. But yeah, I think, you know, if you're not confident from 30 feet, you're just going to get smoked. Like those are the putts you need to make all the time, no matter if there's straddle, trees in your way, whatever. If you're inside the circle, you feel like you need to make it. And, you know, you see guys now when they get hot, they're making it from 40, 50, 60 feet. Like it's nothing.
And, yeah, for sure.
And yeah. So it's,
I think collectively the Pro Tour players, not the Pro Tour as an entity, would probably be on board with smaller baskets if we knew that it caught good putts at the correct rate. Like everything that comes in, you know, center and falling and soft, if all of those stayed in, I'd be happy to play on smaller baskets.
Yeah.
But to date, I'm not sure that one has been produced that accurately does that.
That's fair. I've only putted on, I think, the Marksman basket.
Sure, the DD version?
I think so. Or the Gateway. I think I put it on the Gateway too. Yeah. But they, I mean,
they're really great training tools.
I feel like you need the nose. Like when we used to putt on the Mach 3s and you almost had to land it in the cage. Like you didn't want to blast in there. It was a bad putt. I feel like those catch similar. Like you want to be kind of nose down. You need to be a little softer. If you're going to just blast them in there, like, you know, Ricky or Gannon, they're not going to stay. And so it's a different style of putting for sure.
That kind of leads me to what I'd like to dive in here is the philosophy of putting and how you have been able to understand all the elements of a putt. Ella Hansen and you had a pretty good rapport this year caddying for each other. Mm-hmm. And Ella told me late in the year that she was sick and tired of hearing other people talk about spit outs because she's like, Proctor doesn't have any. He just makes every putt. He puts it in exactly the way it needs to go every time.
Yeah.
He doesn't get spit outs. So you talking about, you know, the way that a putt needs to come in for various basket types. Can you expound on that a little bit? Because I've definitely heard pro tour players say that, you know, some baskets are inferior and we shouldn't be using them at all.
I think I have an advantage in that department because I learned to play on Mach 3s, and it's a basket where you need to sort of be gentle or have your putter finishing into the chains, not like blasting through them in a way. But you're right. Baskets are different. They have different sweet spots. I think, you know, I see a lot of players on tour will miss 2 inches to the right or 2 inches to the left. And, you know, they caught chain, but it wasn't a perfect putt. Like, and they'll call those spit outs all day long. Whereas, you know, myself, I hold myself to a pretty high standard when it comes to putting. So if I miss 2 inches left and it plows into a bunch of chains, I miss the putt. Like sometimes it catches and yeah, that's sweet. But sometimes it doesn't, and you can't really blame the basket for that. You know, you could have put it in a better spot to where that wouldn't happen. And so, you know, with guys who are learning the sport now, and we have all these different baskets and, you know, all these layers of chains and horizontal chains, and manufacturers are really just trying to make a basket that doesn't spit out. And so they just put this wall of chains in there, and what it allows you to do is just blast your putt in as hard as you want, and the basket will catch it. And so, you know, it's just obviously, you know, people pick their aiming points and they're trying to hit the pole and they're trying to, you know, have that perfect putt. And if you miss that, are you blaming the basket or are you blaming yourself? Because, yeah, you know, there's putts that stay half the time and spit half the time, but that's not where you're aiming. You're not trying to get that result. So I think, you know, a lot of people put blame on the basket where they shouldn't. And, you know, when it's windy or certain baskets, I'm not a huge fan of either. You have to, like, you know, for example, when it's windy, I might putt a little harder depending on the wind direction.
You have to. You have to stick it in there.
Exactly. And then when the basket doesn't catch it, I mean, it's frustrating. But, you know, I could probably count on one hand, like, the amount of brutal spit outs I had this year in 800 putts. So, you know, I don't know. It's an annoying part of the game, but I think if you hit your putt where you intended to, you would not spit 99% of the time.
I think the ones that have really been getting to me are the cut throughs where the basket just turns the putt sideways. It goes right by the pole through the inner set of chains and out the back as fast as it came in.
Yeah.
Man, it drives me bats.
It does. And it's frustrating. It's the same thing as, you know, when you throw a great shot and you think you're in the clear and you hit the late tree and you kick into oblivion. And I mean, it's all about losing strokes and gaining strokes. You know, it's for me, like I am more frustrated when I release a putt and I did everything I wanted to, and I still miss, whether I put too much power or not enough, or the wind affected it in a way I didn't think it was going to, than when I just heart a putt and it spits through, because at least I can take that momentum and be like, yeah, you're putting good. Like, that was a great, you know, it's just like, for me, I focus so much this year on not letting those little things get, like, everything will balance itself out, you know? And so I get super lucky on hole three and I sneak through a gap and I'm like, sweet. And then the next time I throw a great shot and I get really unlucky and it's like, okay, you got to know that it's going to work itself out. Like, you can't just focus on the unlucky stuff. And a spit out is just that, you know, if I miss a putt or like it comes out low and I'm like, ooh, that's cage, and it sneaks in, I got to remember that, because the next time I spit out, you know, it kind of cancels out. But a lot of, you just, it's so easy to just focus on the negative and everything that bad happens to you. But I could, you know, at least once, maybe even twice around, I'll let a putt go and I'm like, oh, that's God, that's awful, it's not going in, and it sneaks in.
Yeah, just tucks in low left or some nonsense.
Exactly.
It sounds like you've got a really healthy perspective on this, and I hope you're able to sustain that. That's honestly why I didn't want to have this conversation during the middle of the season.
Yeah.
Because like, having a really meta talk about how you're putting just kind of invites thoughts while you're practicing or something.
Yeah.
But this is also a lot like baseball, where a team can, you know, hit six rockets that get caught by the shortstop, and the other team just like hits a couple seeing eye grounders and bloops a couple into the outfield, and uh-oh, like all of a sudden you lost 2-0 and you shouldn't have.
Yeah, 100%.
So I know that you're a baseball fan. Tell me about the hat you're wearing right now.
So this is a corduroy Expos hat, and I had a corduroy Phillies hat that got ruined, and I just like having the corduroy. I think it's stylish, and I kind of say your outfit's not complete unless you got a hat on. So I had to replace it with something, and I just found this one and I thought it looked good.
There you go. So I'm interested in the passive voice in your Phillies hat getting ruined.
Where I live is very humid, and I bought like an enclosed zipper plastic hat container, and I just stacked like a bunch of hats in there, you know, 30 uh-huh. or 40 hats. And I come back from the tour after being gone for like 3 months or whatever, and I go in there to snag a hat, and like they were all kind of moldy right here and like under the brim a little bit. And so, yeah, it kind of bummed me out. I lost some sweet hats, so I had to go buy a couple more to replace.
Well, a couple thoughts here. You need to invest in a good desiccant.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, you're very style conscious, and you wouldn't. Have you ever seen me wear a hat that you would wear? Like, not just how it looks, but like its cleanliness.
Probably not off the top of my head. No,
not off the top of mine either. I'm wearing the stanky ones.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite Expos player of all time?
Oh man, why you got to do that to me?
Jose Vidro, Orlando Cabrera, Larry Walker, Randy Johnson, Marquise Grissom.
Marquise Grissom.
Pedro Martinez.
Think
about that 90s farm system that's producing outstanding players.
I mean, Pedro Martinez was my guy when he was on Boston. I was Big Poppy and Pedro were like two of my favorite players. I was never really a team guy when it came to baseball. You know, I'm a Dodgers fan, but for some reason, and baseball was my favorite sport growing up, and I was a pitcher, so I always gravitated toward these pitchers. And CC Sabathia was my favorite. Hands down. I really liked Roy Oswalt because my form was similar to him. Pedro Martinez.
You're like 8 inches taller than Roy Oswalt.
I know, but he had the over the head, and people don't really do that anymore. Mm-hmm. Especially when I was a kid, like I was like the only one in my high school, my little league, like everyone just stayed here and I was just over the head. I just loved it. But yeah, so, you know, I kind of bounced around like rooting for teams based on who their pitchers were. And Pedro Martinez, he was one of my guys. So I'll go Pedro.
There you go. Good choice.
Yeah.
Starting in probably the early 2010s, there was a pretty big revolution among Driveline and some other hitting and pitching labs. They would take very high rate cameras and analyze every bit of a hitter's swing or a pitcher's delivery to try to identify inefficiencies or ways that they could impart more force to the ground or to the critical part of that motion. And in some ways, you talking about how a putt needs to enter certain types of baskets is a lot like reverse engineering a pitch, where you can kind of like take a ball to a wind tunnel and figure out like what type of spin would generate different action as it's coming to the plate, like the revolution between slider and sweeper over the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Now in disc golf, we haven't really explored that level of sophisticated technology, whether that's just because we're not a multi-billion dollar industry that you and I are aware of. But can you talk about some of the very critical elements of putting mechanics? And obviously this is not a visual medium, but in such a way that listeners could kind of analyze for themselves where their own inefficiencies are over the winter?
Yeah, you know, I think similar to how any sports mechanics start, I think you need to look at your feet and the base that you create. And, you know, some common mistakes that I see is a lot of players are standing too tall. And what I mean by that is, if you widen your feet just by 6 inches, just kick your back foot back another 6 inches, it allows you to kind of sit your weight on that back foot easier. And then the push forward, that weight transfer, just becomes so much more smooth and efficient. And, you know, I see a lot of players stand tall and do that rock where they like lean back and then go forward, mm-hmm, to generate that power. And your balance when you're doing that is just so much less stable, as opposed to if you just widen your feet and kind of just sit on that back leg and come forward. So the first thing I look at is the feet, and I'm always playing around with my feet. You know, I'm kind of staggered. My back foot is like similar to like a kicker in football. Like I'm back probably 2 or 3 feet and then over like 6 inches, my back foot compared to my left foot. And you know, if I'm like missing high that day or missing low or left, I keep tweaking my back foot till it feels comfortable. I'll move it in an inch, right an inch, and I'm just always kind of playing around with that back foot.
So you can definitely do that during a putting practice session where all you're doing is putting, but it seems like during a round, you only have like 7 to 10 critical putts. Everything else is either a tap in or a little too far to be thinking, I have to make this.
Yeah. And I think it depends on how I miss it. Like if I miss it and it just felt bad, I'll play around with my foot. Even if my next putt is from 9 feet, I'll kind of feel out that foot and putt it and be like, okay, I'm going to go with this now. Or I'll just stick with it. You know, if I miss 2 putts in a row, something's changing. I don't care if it's the putter, if it's my feet, like obviously this isn't working. And now I'm thinking about it. I'm changing my foot and I'm like resetting my confidence. And I'm saying, okay, this is going to work now. Now we got it. And if I make the next one, I'll stick with that. But, you know, if I miss 2 putts like early in the round, I'm not going to stick with that and hope it works for the third putt. Because I'm always, you know, it's something that I'm just used to because I do it every round. But I'm always kind of playing with that back foot and seeing what feels comfortable that day. And it's not a perfect system, but most of the time, if I just scoop my back foot back an inch and just sit lower on my legs, mm-hmm, that solves the problem.
So I think when you're dropping your back foot back, and let's assume like level ground, minimal wind, et cetera, mm-hmm, I think what that enables you to do is put the swing path of your arm more towards the basket, mm-hmm, because you're pushing from on your back foot to your front foot. It's making your trajectory like more linear directly towards the basket. Does that sound right?
Definitely. And that's what allows me, you know, I'm not one of those guys that jump putts at 34 feet.
Uh-huh.
And that's because I generate my power from my legs. So if you just watch my arm on a 15 footer and a 40 footer, my goal is that my arm looks the same and my legs are just generating more power.
Yeah.
And you know, it requires a little more spin to do that, but you know, the other mistake I see a lot is guys are putting 35, 40 footers and they have like the softer putt and they're trying to reach it. And so they start throwing it more and then they miss right and then they miss left. And you don't want to generate the extra power from your arm. You want to generate it from your legs. And
yeah, I totally agree. And continuing with like a linear theme, I have found that when I'm missing right or left, it's because I'm like I'm rotating my hips, or my push from my back foot is it's moving from back left to front right. Instead of keeping, even if my hips aren't aligned directly at the basket, they need to be in the same orientation from my furthest point back until I've released.
Yes, definitely. And I think that's where you need to play around. Like if you're a staggered stance guy, it's really easy for your weight to shift to the right because your back foot is back left. And so that's where you really need to play around. But you know, when you're doing your dry runs or you're feeling it out, a lot of people say shake hands with the pole. And you know, it's not something I think about while I'm putting, but it's something that I kind of want to make sure, because it's just an illusion of where your weight transfer is going. Is it going to the right or is it going straight at the basket? And you want it to be going straight at the basket.
I'm Eric Oakley, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I think about what I'm going to do for a Klondike bar.
I'm Thomas Gilbert, and I listen to the Fish Golf broadcast while I'm traveling to the next stop.
If you like where this show is headed, stick around for part two. We'll never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads to start the show. So please support the Fish Golf broadcast by visiting discgolfbra.com for hats and other apparel. Fish stamp discs are available at fishdiscgolf.com and daddydiscgolf.com, and you can save 10% on upperparkdiscgolf.com with the code Andrew10 on backpacks and other items. And now, more lies and outrageous claims from our guest, met with calm reason by Fish.
Can you talk about the philosophy of using your wrist in the putt?
Yeah, it's... the wrist is interesting. And I think, you know, you see guys like, or even Owen, for example, Owen and Chris Dickerson are the main two I think of with the super wobbly putt. And yeah. I had someone ask about this yesterday, you know, is the wobble bad? Should I try to get it out? And I said, I mean, you know, Owen and Chris are two of the best putters we have on tour, and they're super wobble, super flut. And so I can't say it's a bad thing. You know, it's not something that's ever happened to me when I'm putting. And I think that's just because I think if you wobble, there's an imbalance between like how much power you're generating with your arm and how much wrist you have. And so when I was trying to lengthen my putt last year, I was horrible from circle two, and I was kind of putting softer and higher because I was scared to miss long and all this stuff. And so this off season, I tried to add a little bit more spin to it. I was talking to Macbeth last year. He hit a putt at the end of Portland Open. He hit like a 60-foot elevated putt right to left wind, and his putt just went like straight the whole time. And I was like, how do you do that? How did your putt not fade? How do you do that? And you know, he was saying, especially in the wind, but generally like longer putts, elevated putts, you just try to keep the nose angle as flat as possible and spin it. And you know, if you just started on that trajectory, if your nose angle is flat, the wind's not going to affect it as much. The chains will get in the way. And so that's kind of something I just took for all my circle two putts, is I just, you know, I add a little more wrist, I add a little more spin just to keep that putter kind of penetrating forward a little bit quicker. But, you know, it's just finding that balance. And I think it just takes thousands of repetitions, you know, adding a little bit more wrist, a little less wrist. You know, spin putters, that's all wrist, but like the push, the sploosh, whatever people call it, the hybrid, it's just that balance of, you know, finding out what's going to work for you, what feels like, you know, like we said earlier with swinging and everything, you know, no one's going to be the exact same. So you got to find out kind of what works for you and just practice it. And putting is all about confidence. You know, you could have I've played with guys that do like the turbo putt and they're amazing putters. Mm-hmm. And it's just confidence and repetition. Like you step up, you know, it's going to go in, and then you throw it. And most of the time it does.
Can we talk about push versus spin and various styles of putters on tour right now?
I think kind of my main way to diagnose if it's a spin or a push putt is where you miss, because there's so many like blends and hybrids now. Essentially, I think if your miss is left or right, I think you're a spin putter. And if your miss is high or low, I think you're a push putter. I'm not saying that's accurate, but that's kind of because the spin is like kind of more belly button and your wrist is coming this way, your miss is going to be like along the horizontal plane. To whereas if you're push putting, your wrist is more this way, your miss is going to be on the vertical plane. So, you know, I think the main spin putter that I think of is Simon, and he's tweaked his putt and he's softened his putt a little bit. But if you watch him, like he doesn't really miss low or high very often. He's usually a left or right miss guy.
Yeah.
And to me, and I was never a spin putter growing up, it looks so casual. Like Isaac Robinson's another one. And Ezra too. You know, I was playing with them. You feel like they just have the shoulder strap. They don't even take their bag off and they just kind of stand up mid-sentence and just spin it in there from 60 feet. And that's how they, it's so fun to watch them putt because it looks so casual and effortless.
I think a big theme among those guys is they've all been doing this for 20 years.
True.
And I wonder if, you know, the players who started really, really young before they could, before they had enough mass to actually put their mass behind a Frisbee,
mm-hmm.
They had to kind of throw it. And then eventually that evolved into a, you know, a more spinny putt.
Yeah.
But there's kind of been a convergence in the last, I don't know, even 10 years where almost everybody is some kind of hybrid between push and spin. You know, you used mm-hmm. to have Steve Brinster, all push.
Yeah.
And then there would be guys like Yeti or Steve Rico who were all spin.
Yeah.
Do you have any ideas of where everybody kind of started gravitating towards the middle?
I mean, my first idea would be Macbeth. He was, you know, a lot of players now were probably coming up in that 2012 through 2015 range. And He was the guy you looked at. And he was kind of that hybrid, you know. I think the baskets probably had a little something to do with it. Because you're right. I mean, if you go back to like Barry and Climo and Brinster, like that's, I almost call that like a pitch putt. Like they're not even finishing through. They're just kind of popping it and then, you know, landing it in the bucket.
And that's a nose down Mach 3 type putt.
Exactly. The main guy that I, from my area that I think about when I think of a pitch putt was Patrick Brown.
Yeah.
And he was always, he, you know, his thought process was, I'm going to land this in the bucket. I'm not even going to need the chains. Yeah. It's totally evolved. I think for our sport, you know, when you think about like Paul and Rick, they really were the two that expanded our circle. And if you wanted to compete with them, you had to make the 50 footers. And, you know, the only guy that can make a 50 footer with that style of putt is Barsby because he puts it, you know, 30 feet in the air. But in order to kind of, I mean, they just pushed the envelope for what was possible with putting. And, you know, if you wanted to compete with them and if you wanted to be like them, you had to figure out how to make a 50 footer. And that kind of, I think, is what brought more of this spin hybrid, you know, sploosh or whatever it's called, putt into the game. But I would credit Macbeth to a lot of that.
Okay. And then the proliferation of media where every kid has seen all these different putting styles mm-hmm. comes out expecting to make 50 footers, but also can adapt their putt. Can you talk about the adaptability of what you're trying to do and maybe a couple scenarios that folks could go dive for where like you completely changed how you putted in between a couple holes?
Yeah, I think, you know, for one, I know a lot of people who, let's say they're on the side of a hill and they switch to a straddle because it's just awkward to use a stagger stance when you're on the side of a hill. Yeah, and
better, you know, better side-to-side balance.
Exactly. And so just being able to, I think it's a comfortability thing. When I was working on my putt, I would play rounds where I only straddled just to get comfortable with it. And then you can kind of, you know, just figure things out. I think of it like watching basketball. And LeBron throws up this crazy one-hand floater that just looks like, you know, how could he ever make that? And everyone's like, you know, he practices those shots. He doesn't want to be in a situation in a game where he's doing something he's never practiced. And I kind of take that with putting. You know, I'll practice from a knee. I'll practice Anheuser and Heiser and, you know, needing to move my foot out here because I'm in a bush or you know, just even the Hebenheimer, the horseshoe putt, you know, mm-hmm. I had to bust that out at Portland Open. Just, I don't want to be, especially inside the circle, I don't want to not be confident that I'm going to make it because I'm in a situation that I've never practiced. And so I think it's just getting comfortable. You know, I'm not saying you have to perfect every style of putt, but just comfortable, just good enough to where, you know, you feel like you can give it a chance and you're not totally hopeless.
You can modulate a lot of different things here, whether that's wing angle mm-hmm. or nose angle or the height that you're trying to start the putt. How do you go about practicing those things? Like when you're thinking about, say, nose angle, what does a practice session look like for you? Are you trying to like go through all the different angles between, say, minus 10 and plus 10 degrees with the nose?
No, and that's something that's hard to simulate if you're, you know, putting in your backyard. I think that's more of the situation where, and you know, I've been playing for too many years, but if you're on a course in a practice round and you come up to a tricky putt that, you know, requires a nose down or requires kind of like, you know, you got to drop to a knee and kind of blast it to keep the nose up. If it's a tricky putt, I'll putt it 4 or 5 times. Like, you know, I'll putt it with my 3 putters and then I'll go back and I'll do it again just to kind of get used to it. And I think that's something I also learned from Macbeth. Masters Cup, hole 7 is that, have you played Masters Cup? De La Viega?
No, I never have. It's one of my greatest regrets as a disc golfer, and I'm a stain on the community for not going to De La.
Man, well, this is, I mean, it's an amazing example of preparing for a tournament. And hole 7 is straight downhill, and it kind of fades off on both sides, and there's bushes and stuff, and it's really hard to get the disc to finish straight downhill.
Yeah.
And so Macbeth fades off left, 30 footers in these bushes and trees, and he cashes a sweet putt. And, you know, everyone's amazed. I don't think I played a practice round with him. I think he was in front of him or behind him. But he putted from that area for like 10 minutes.
Huh.
Because he's like, this is where my drives land. I'm going to throw it here. And I'm just going to figure out all the little putting zones and angles. And do I want to go over this branch or do I want to, you know, blast it underneath? So, you know, that's a very specific example on a specific hole. You can't really do that, you know, for everything. But If you find a spot that has like a bunch of different putting scenarios and a bunch of different tricky windows, spend 5 minutes in there. Like play around with your putt. See, one might look easier, but if you're just more comfortable or more consistent hitting a certain angle or, you know, a certain nose angle, a certain speed, learn that. Like, you know, take the extra 5 minutes to kind of explore with your putt a little bit and find out what is more consistent for you. Because it's going to be different for everyone. You know, some people will be way better at hitting the low gap, but some people, you know, like Barsby will be better at hitting the high gap. So you just kind of figure that out. And not every course is going to have that, but that's something that I practice during a practice round when I just stumble upon a putt like that. That's not something I really practice in the backyard.
Can we go back to thinking about wobble versus like clean spin? So I am obsessive about clean spin.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of didn't care for it a few years ago when Macbeth was talking about wanting putts to come in with wobble because it would catch better in the chains. Other people have given other justifications for wobble. Like I think I remember hearing Yeti talk about not giving the wind the same surface to work with. Hmm. Like if his putt wobbles, then it can't lift or it can't drop or something. My philosophy is if there's a wind, I'm trying to make the flight plate get smashed by it rather than lifted by it.
Okay.
And I want my putt to come clean because, you know, the chains are going to do what the chains are going to do. I would much rather control all of the flight that gets me to that point.
Yes.
Any thoughts on that? Like who's right, who's wrong, or who just has something that works for them and keep doing it?
You know, I'll go back to that putt, just talking to Macbeth about nose angle and keeping it flat. You know, I want anything that I can keep predictable, I will. And so when Yeti's talking about using wobble and exposing nose angle, that sounds scary to me.
Not necessarily nose, but wing angle too.
Yeah. I've never putted with wobble, so I don't know, you know, firsthand how it reacts, or I can't really think of a reason why I would want to. I'm in your boat. I want to control my putter getting into the chains. If the chains don't catch it, that's fine, but I did my job and I controlled what I can control. Mm-hmm. And I will never adjust my putt in fear of spitting out. I'm always going to kind of count on that basket to catch it. And if it doesn't, then, oh, well, maybe I'll catch a nice break later on in the round. But I'm never going to change my putt in fear of spitting out.
Yeah, I think, like, more generally, anytime you start a throw with the mentality of, I don't want it to spit out, or I don't want it to roll away, or I don't want to throw it out of bounds, it's you're trying to manifest that in some way.
It's hard. And, you know, it's hard. You know, the guy in front of you catches a nice 40-footer and it spits, and then you're up with a 30-footer. Like, that putt just got significantly harder because you're thinking about it. And it's, you know, that's part of that mental battle of just talking yourself out of it. And, you know, you just got to switch to that focus of only thinking about making it. And, you, like you said, not worrying about what happens if I miss, what happens if it spits. You know, you can't be thinking about any of that when you putt. But it's easier said than done, because when it happens in the round, in the moment, it's brutal.
So you've said, like, numerous times, like, you just have to practice it. You just have to practice it. And I'm sorry, I wanted to diverge real quick and say, all of our listeners who, although they're very talented, special people, heard you say, I don't putt with wobble, and they just paused and yelled, must be fucking nice. So you've said numerous times, like, how important it is to practice, whether that's, you know, your default putt or tricky ones. Do you do, like, practice games, or do you just kind of go putt? Like, what does that look like for you, and what are you trying to get out of a putting session?
I think there's two things you have to, or the main thing you have to look at is, are you putting to get reps in, or are you putting to work on something? You know, are you working on your form? Because in that case, you can play games, but my biggest thing is keep it inside 25 feet. You know, if you're working on something and you're scooting back to 40 after five putts, game over. It's not going to work. So, you know, for me, my putt is established. I'm not tweaking anything. I'm not changing any of the mechanics of it. I'm just getting reps. So the only game I'll play is horse. And I love horse, just to add that little bit of added pressure, you know. And even then, I'm not a huge fan of playing horse and then the guy goes back to 60 feet and just starts putting, you know, bombs. Like, I want to keep it realistic, like, actually get round practice in. But for the most part, you know, I'll putt for 5 or 10 minutes, and not even every day, maybe 3 times a week. I'll start from 15. I'll make, you know, 6, 8 in a row. I'll scoot back to 20, scoot back to 25, scoot back to 30, hit like 10 straddles, back to 20, and then I'm done. I don't mess around anything outside like 40 feet. I don't even bother unless I'm like warming up for a round or a tournament round. And because I just don't have that much room in my backyard. but I just, my only goal is to just like feel good and make putts. Right. So I want, when I'm doing my practice putting, I want it to be like 95% makes.
Yeah. You're training yourself as you make putts, and then what it feels like to make putts.
Exactly.
How is your default putt changed over time? And was that a conscious effort?
My default putt, you know, I'd be really curious to look at a video. I know for a little bit, I was very upper body and my feet were very close together, and I would kind of just toss it in there. And I consciously changed that because of my issue outside of 40 feet. It was really consistent inside the circle. Similar to, like, not what Niklas does, you know, when he's close, when he just kind of leans over and just tosses it in.
Yeah.
Similar to that effect, not exactly that. But I made, and that was probably 2012 or 13. I said, you know what, like, I need more legs. Like, this is not going to work. And so that's been like the last big adjustment. And then, well, no. So actually last offseason, I added more spin to it. And that was mainly for the 30 to 50 range. I just wanted to get more used to just spinning them a little bit harder, a little more direct. You know, my main thing, what I tell Ella all the time is like, even if you don't think you're going to make it, you're good enough to give it a chance. So don't miss it low, like spin it, you know, give it a chance to go in. And sometimes it will, sometimes it won't, but you know, at least have the courage to give it a chance. The word, you know, when I'm kind of doubting myself and then I just loft this little low thing that doesn't even reach the cage, like that's so frustrating.
It wasn't worth it. You should have just laid it up and then you would have executed your game plan.
Exactly. So I kind of, you know, I vowed to myself this year that I was going to just give putts a chance and kind of tweak that back into like a positive, you know, a positive thing that I was thinking about. But I haven't changed a whole lot of mechanics, especially like the lower half in a while. I'm happy with where it's at and I've kind of kept it there.
Yeah, sure. So pretty clearly you're a student of putting, both for yourself, but also observing how other people do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me some examples of players who do something well with their putt that you like, or you might think about borrowing?
Interesting. I mean, the one that comes to mind, because it's so unique and I've never seen it done as successful as he does it, is Gannon. And coming from that kind of left hip and like almost adding a small throw to it.
Yeah.
Just, and I think that's probably because when he was learning to putt, he was just a little kid and he needed that extra power to putt the 40 footers and he kind of just grew into it.
Now, I think it's important to say he's still a little twerp, although he's not a little kid anymore.
Yeah, no, it's, but just watching, you know, everything he does is really impressive because it's so precise and, you know, slow and methodical. But that's a putt where my dad kind of putted like that. He was a little more of a throw and he didn't have that same, you know, wrist snap at the end that Gannon does.
Yeah.
You know, my dad kind of tossed it in there a little hyzer. And I thought it was the ugliest putt. And so to watch Gannon do it, I'm like, oh my God, it works though. You know, like how does he come back from here and how is it so consistent? I don't know, but I love it. I love just how confident and how he commits on certain putts, especially the scary ones. You know, he's not thinking about anything but making it. And I don't know that for a fact. That's just what I gather from watching him putt. He's attacking the basket. And yeah, I mean, I don't love how hard he putts sometimes because you can spit. And I think, you know, it's the classic Ricky thing. You know, Ricky jams a 20 footer and it spits and it's like, well, did you need to put it that hard? but yeah, something that I would kind of use or steal from someone, I can't really think of off the top of my head. I'm extremely happy with where my putt is. Like, I'm not looking to change it or to add anything at this point. Honestly, it's just the mental, the confidence, the courage. That's where I think everyone could use some, you know, improvement or just the ability to kind of commit and trust yourself to, like, if I'm putting a scary putt, I'm trusting myself in anywhere inside 50 to like at least hit something. And then that gives me the courage to run it. But if I think I'm going to air ball, yeah, I'll lay it up.
Now that 50 is your range, there may be listeners who are thinking, you know, 20 is their range,
mm-hmm.
that they're going to hit something. And it's totally okay for that to be your journey. You know, like, disc golf is a sport for everybody. It's also really easy to say, you know what, I'm going to step up. I'm going to be confident. I'm going to give everything a chance. And then you get up to that during the round and you got nothing.
Yeah.
And you've only got 30 seconds to talk yourself into it.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Yeah, so it's funny, like Ella will ask me, you know, are you running this? And I said, I don't know, I'll see how it feels when I step up there. And once I address my lie, still I'll have no idea if I'm running it or not. If it's like, you know, pretty tricky. If I'm inside 40, I'm running it no matter what. Like, yeah. I trust myself to hit something. But, you know, if it's tricky, if it's windy, if there's water right behind, I won't make that decision until I step up to the putt and I just see how it looks at that moment. And if I look at that basket and I think, this is cash, then I make up my mind and I'm going. If I look at that basket and I think, oh, this is like tough. Like, maybe if I had three tries, you know, then I'll lay it up. But I don't make that decision until I see how it feels, you know, until I really step up and feel that wind, which way is the wind going, or, you know, just to, cause I can feel it. And maybe that's because I've been playing for so long. Like, I don't know, maybe that doubt creeps into other people quicker. But if there's any doubt, if I'm like, if I look at that putt and I think, ooh, I'm laying up, like I'm not talking myself into it. You know, if I'm running it, then I'm committed. I don't need to talk myself into it. I'm excited about it. I'm ready to make it. But if that's not there, I'm out.
Okay. How do you avoid self-judgment or negative self-talk when you, like, you completely believed in a putt and you gave it an okay effort, but it airballed, it went back down the hill, it rolled away, whatever, and you take a bogey or something. How do you deal with that?
I mean, you have to accept the result when you do something risky. You know, if you're running a risky approach or, you know, a risky tee shot, you have to be willing to accept that result if it doesn't work out. And so that's kind of, I guess that weighs into my process, you know, is this really worth it? Like, do I need this stroke that bad? And if I do, and I want it, and I run it, and it was a bad putt, you know, oh well. Like, that's the risk you take. I think if you take my whole year and break down all the stats and the choices I made when I chose to run it or I chose to lay up, I'm willing to bet it worked out in my favor. Like, I came out ahead. And so, you know, I know, you know, not every shot is going to work out. You know, I'm not going to birdie all 18 holes. I'm not going to make every putt. And you just have to be willing to accept that. And you have to be able to kind of turn that page really quick and make the next one. And I think about putts. One thing that I think helps me as I think about putts is opportunities. You know, I'll throw a good drive and hit a late tree and it kicks a 40. You know, most people are pissed and complaining about the tree. And I'm just telling myself, you have an opportunity to make it. Like, go take advantage of this opportunity. And so, you know, if I miss a scary putt and it rolls to 40, I have another opportunity. That's all I'm thinking. Like, make this one. It doesn't always work, but, you know, before you putt it, before you make that decision, you know, you have to be willing to accept the consequence. And, you know, you made that choice, so you can't let yourself get too bent out of shape about it.
Thank you so much for sharing so much of your time and like all of your putting expertise. I know that you've worked with a couple other players on tour or offered to help them. Can you tell me about a success story where, like, you could see noticeable improvement in somebody that you helped coach up a little bit?
I mean, just, you know, thinking back to to Throw Pink with Evelina and watching her putt, and, you know, in her mind, she's thinking grip lock, especially though, like, the, I think it was round two or three when it kind of got hot and a little sticky, like, she's just, I'm going to grip lock, I'm going to shank it right. And so kind of mentally coaching her out of it. And even, you know, there was one putt where it was like tough putt and I'm almost like, ooh, maybe just lay this up, but she wanted to run it and she missed it, but she was right on line. I think she just hit band.
Yeah.
But just to see that kind of confidence grow and that mental shift from I'm going to grip lock to I might be able to make this, that was pretty cool. And, you know, she's been texting me all off season, like, she's motivated and putting and, you know, trying to work through kind of the mental block that she has with putting. But there was a lot of improvement at that tournament and that was cool to see.
Awesome. Well, if you enjoyed this podcast and want to lavish praise on me, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at fish58320. And if you hated the podcast, you found the guest dreadfully dull and want to holler about his baseball opinions, where can folks find you?
James Proctor. I'm on Instagram something. I got to look. Yeah, James _ Proctor.
Good social media influencer here.
Yep. That's me.
That's all for this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast. But be sure to check out previous episodes and subscribe wherever fine podcasts are sold. Check out Fish Golf Broadcast hats and other apparel at discgolfbra.com and badger your friends until they listen too. Join us next time as I goad yet another guest into starting a fight with another touring player, campsite host, or toll booth attendant. on the Fish Golf Broadcast.